So compassion and wisdom are often spoken of as the two wings of Buddhism. And they're both necessary. They support each other, and they're really not separate. And I think we can each, you know, emphasize one particular aspect of practice or more drawn to it. I know for me, I was much more interested in the wisdom piece of it than the compassion piece. And over the last, I guess I started in December giving a talk on metta or loving kindness, and I decided to do compassion. Mostly I want to talk about this evening is compassion. Maybe I'll even take on appreciative joy and equanimity in the next couple of talks, I don't know. But I find it really helpful, and I don't know if this would be true for you or not, is really to take a topic on that's of interest to you or maybe a sticking point to you and just really go deeply into it. Investigate it every way you can. That's kind of what I try and do with talks, is to take on things that I haven't talked about. It'd be easy to dig up some old ones. And just, okay, what is compassion? What is compassion practice? How do I manifest it in my life rather than talking about it from something I've read or somebody else's talk? So compassion might be thought of as a response of love to suffering. And it is one of the four, what are sometimes called Brahmaviharas, which are usually translated as divine abodes, or Appamanya, which I prefer because it's translated as the boundless qualities of heart. These boundless qualities of heart are metta, which is usually translated as loving kindness, or sometimes goodwill, sometimes non-aversion. So it has a wide range of qualities to it. And then compassion, then appreciative joy, which is love appreciating the joy of others, the joy of life. And equanimity, which is love expressed as trust, as a trust that we can hold, we can meet what is there. So these qualities are the qualities that really bring us into the relative world, into the world of human relationships. They're qualities that allow us to live in harmony with ourselves and with others. And I think it's interesting, actually, that to me, may not be to you, I don't know, John Peacock, who translated for the Dalai Lama as a Buddhist scholar, said that these aspects of the Buddhist teaching are the most important part of the Buddhist teaching. So wisdom gets emphasized so much. And you know, we don't want to choose one or the other, but they're extremely important. They're not just something for, you know, namby-pambies or something. And wisdom really, so you could think of compassion as caring for suffering, response to suffering. And wisdom is something really to free us from suffering, to see through this sense of identity that the me is all this is happening to. And it also, you know, when we see, the wisdom provides a basis for compassion. So I want to say a little bit about wisdom tonight, but mostly I want to talk about compassion. And there are layers and layers of depth to both wisdom and compassion. At one layer, the wisdom aspect is that everything's impermanent. It's so obvious, isn't it? I mean, we all know that, but we don't live that way. Every emotion comes and goes. I love Ajahn Sucitto. One of his favorite quotes for me is, "You can't guarantee happiness, but you can guarantee it won't last." Sense experiences come and go, pleasant, unpleasant. You know, we see something that's really great, we really like it, next thing you know, it's gone, and there's some unpleasant experience. Relationships, you know, we might be in a wonderful relationship and maybe something horrible happens to our partner, or our partner betrays us. Jobs, just endless. You know, your car, you get your new car, and then somebody smashes it, and you come out, and there's all banged up, and no note. You know, that's life, right? Sometimes, rather than impermanence, it's referred to as conditionality. that every moment is a coming together of conditions, and conditions change. Joseph Goldstein finds it reassuring that anything can happen any time. I mean, if we can somehow open to that, rather than trying to protect ourselves from it, to really, you know, and part of this wisdom is to know our vulnerability or fragility of all human beings. And that provides, in some sense, a source for compassion. We so much try to protect ourselves, to defend ourselves. My wife, who's a therapist, used to always tell me I'm very well defended. I said, what do you mean? I'm not well defended. Just had rational. So when we see that there's nothing we can hold on to, what do? I mean, in some sense, that's the way most people live in this world, is to keep trying to arrange things so that if you know, we have good emotions, pleasant sense experience, good partners, good jobs. And, you know, that seems like a reasonable thing to do, but it's kind of like rearranging the chairs chairs on the Titanic, or, you know, it just can't be done. So it's not that we shouldn't take care of ourselves, but to realize that there's actually something that's okay with this, that's okay with not having any particular state, this quality of empathic awareness. And so much of practice is learning to at first it seems like a witness, to step back and see what's going on. But over time, there's just this awareness that's just there. It's perfectly fine with anything that goes on. Now, I'm not saying we're always there all the time, but more and more, you can start realizing, just notice a moment when there's no wanting, no trying to get rid of something. Notice a moment when you can just really open to an unpleasant emotion. So, you know, when we see that everything's impermanent, then we know that everything is inherently unsatisfactory. Sometimes it's called, you know, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, stress, dissatisfaction, and that there's nothing we can cling to as me or mine. You know, this body, it changes, emotions come and go, sense experiences come and go. So is that what we are, if they're constantly changing? I mean, seeing through this, and so this is like the three marks of existence: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. The Buddha never said there wasn't a self. He just said, don't cling to anything that is changing as self, because it causes suffering. And if it's changing, how can it be you? I find that delightful. I'm sitting up here, and these thoughts go through my mind. Like, I remember there was a wonderful teacher who had early onset Alzheimer's, and he was up here teaching one night, and he forgot who he was and what he was doing here. It was a very poignant talk, because he talked about his experience. And then Duck Phillips, who I think is a wonderful teacher, came here one night and just couldn't say anything. And I was kind of watching these thoughts, and I thought, this is interesting. I mean, rather than to think of you and identify them and think, well, you know, just it's just floating thoughts just come through the mind, and there's some stuff charged underneath it that's driving it. Well, when I say all things are impermanent, that's one layer of wisdom. But the deep layer of wisdom is there are no things. Everything that we perceive is a construction, a fabrication of the mind and the way our sense experiences work. And we lock into them. So life is kind of like a rainbow. You know, there's dew, moisture in the air. There's light coming in at a particular angle. Actually, 42 degrees, I looked it up. and the way our eyes work interacts with the dewdrops and light and creates an image of rainbow. But you know, when you try and get to the rainbow, it's not there. And in fact, you can see someone standing in front of the rainbow and they're seeing another rainbow at another angle. And the sense of what we are is, in fact, and everything that exists is kind of like a rainbow. Conditions come together and they create an appearance of things. So one of the things that happens, you know, if we look at each other right now, there's the sense of, you know, you objects out there, me object up here, space, time, that's all creation of the mind. It all where is it all happening? It's all happening back here somewhere, right? There's an image goes through the eyes, there's some image in there, and then the mind infers that there's a me that's seeing, and there's space and time. So this is some level of wisdom. And what it is that everything, if everything's coming together conditions, that means that everything is interconnected and interdependent. Now, you can say that intellectually, but when you really experience that deeply, there's a shift in consciousness where there isn't any separation. And from that, compassion naturally arises. Robert Thurman, who's a Buddhist scholar and kind of a, in my mind, I won't say this, who's a Buddhist scholar who actually said that emptiness is the womb of compassion. It's the membrane that nourishes compassion, because when we see our inner relationship, when you look into the eyes of a beloved and you realize there's not a me watching you, but there's this kind of these, whatever you want to language it, these quantum particles flying around creating this incredibly powerful mystical experience, then there's a real sense of aliveness and connection. So I want to read a little quote by Albert Einstein. A human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He, she experiences him, herself, thoughts and feelings as something separate from the rest. A kind of optical illusion, delusion, of his consciousness. So this is kind of what I spoke about this inference that there's a me seeing. It's actually a delusion of the mind that we're separate from all this. This delusion is a kind of a prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion and embrace all living creatures and the whole nature in its beauty. So when we really see we're really part of this whole universe, then compassion, caring for everything naturally arises. And so our practice is to see through what limits us. I sent this to a good friend of mine, a long-term friend, and he said, well, he wrote this. I thought it was so nice, I just wanted to read it. He said, just makes sense to me, a kind of humility to infinity. To find myself alive and present in all of this releases a kind of joy. Like those times when we hear every raindrop or see every star, see into the eyes of the raccoon in our backyard and realize whatever this is, I'm part of it. So the Buddha saw this and he had a state of bliss. I mean, and actually, you know, this impermanence is not all bad news. I mean, it's vibrant. It's alive when we're not locked in concepts. It's just so much going on every moment. I just see the expressions on the faces and right here, right now. So he could have sat around in bliss, but he didn't. Out of what's called anukampa, which is usually translated as empathy, the sense of all the suffering that's going on in the world, he came back and spent the rest of his life teaching. And that act of teaching to moving out is what we call compassion, which has a slightly different, is a different word, is karuna. And the difference between, so empathy is kind of the ability to sense the inner state of another person. It's the ability to take another person's perspective, to feel with what it's like for them. And, you know, it naturally arises, right? I mean, so other mammals take care of little babies because they just see it. It's something. These are all qualities of the human heart. They're naturally there. And we simply need to see what's, well, not simply, we need to see what blocks them. So compassion, then, is often described classically as trembling or quivering of the heart in response to pain, which is really the karuna part, and the wish that beings be free of the pain and sorrow. It has a quality of tenderness to it. I love that word, tenderness. The heart is open. And compassion is not necessarily an emotional state. It's a way of living in this very fragile and unpredictable world. It's really to bring care to ourselves and to others because we are vulnerable and fragile. And so it involves not particularly just emotions, but qualities like wisdom and equanimity and determination and perseverance. A whole lot of qualities come together to support this quality of compassion. And equanimity is essential, which arises in some sense out of this understanding. This is how things are. They're impermanent and fragile. And I was thinking, you know, a loved one who just went through so much difficulty. I was on retreat last week, and I was sitting, and just this memory came up. And then it was sort of like just realizing, like, we can't protect ourselves or others from this. This deep acceptance that this is how it is. Not in the sense of resignation, but this is it. We can't protect others from suffering. It doesn't mean we don't care, but we can't fix it. So trembling really means to be moved by suffering, willing to feel instead of the heart closing. And that's not easy. It takes courage. That's part of the qualities we need to have for compassion. It's holding suffering until it changes on its own. Really willing to be with it. That's so much of what practice is about, of developing enough steadiness, enough sense of spaciousness, enough equanimity to be able to be with it and not lost in it. So I want to talk a little bit about how to work with our own suffering, dissatisfaction, because if we can't really do that, we really can't care for others. And the first thing to do is to notice that it's occurring. There's some sort of suffering or stress or dissatisfaction. And a lot of times we don't know that because we're protecting ourselves from it. We've got these habitual ways of closing down. Narayan told a wonderful story in one of my early retreats, and she's repeated it since, so I think I can use it too. When she first came here, God, this place was so different then, and she was practicing with Larry. And Narayan's a guiding teacher, for those who don't know her. And she was leaving a friend in another spiritual tradition. And she was really having a difficult time with this person. And Larry said, "I'm sorry you're suffering so much." And Narayan said, "Suffering? I'm not suffering. I just hate her." So anytime there's some sort of ill will or, you know, desire for something, there's some form of suffering. So once we recognize there's suffering, then to shift our whole way of seeing things. This is really radical about Buddhism versus the Abrahamic traditions. Rather than seeing things as good and bad, or should be this way or should be that way, is there suffering or not? And we look at everything in terms of there's suffering and how to bring it to an end. And I'm using suffering, but it's really a really subtle word. I mean, the Pali word dukkha actually kind of means any sense of someone outside the experience. It's something we wouldn't even consider any form of stress or dissatisfaction. So it's really looking at the world in terms of suffering and what brings it to an end. And then when we open to the fact that there is some sort of suffering, rather than trying to fix it, push it away, or I'll be with it for a while as long as you'll leave. It's called bargaining, right? To really see if we can open to it. And that takes a skill. And so I think in some sense, learning to be with minor difficulties is a way to start. In an actual formal practice, the intention is to have a container, some sort of environment where it's manageable. So we're out in the world and really out in the fire, we develop some skill to work with it. So we often tend to react to suffering and try and get to block it, the pain. We go up in the head. We tell stories. We blame. We might blame someone else. We might blame ourselves. We often have fear. We might feel helpless. What I found out I do is I just stop breathing, you know. Kind of numb it. You know, you numb it out. You don't feel it. Going up in the head is the same thing. You kind of move away from the body where all the feelings need to be released into some way of trying to get rid of it. And the bad news is that doesn't work. And that's what's so radical about this practice in some sense. It's like open to it. Because when you're having difficult emotions, what's happening? There's one part that doesn't want the difficult emotion, right? But they're both mental experiences going on. It's one part of mind fighting the other part of mind. And so the practice is really to bring compassion to whatever is there. All these parts that you just wish you never had, you know? The defender, the hurt one, the inadequate one. Rather than trying to get rid of it, which is just one part of yourself struggling with another part of yourself, and you can never be whole that way, is to care for each of these parts. You know, to run from suffering, to push away, not only prevents healing, it also just, we end up living a life of denial, of fear. It's just less poignant. And it isn't that we don't have emotions. We do have emotions. And they're actually more poignant when we open to them. But it's a sense of aliveness. So, you know, as difficult as it is, this is the way we transform. To sit here and work with the difficulty. And that's why so many people come to meditation. They think, oh, I'm just going to learn to, you know, calm myself, get these good feelings, no stress, and then, you know, all this stuff happens. And Narayan used to come up to me when I first started teaching and saying, people come to these classes like wine tasting parties, you know. And by what she meant was that, you know, don't be disappointed when they don't all stay. I was actually filling in for another teacher who was teaching at the Cambridge Adult Education Center, and he had to go away, and he asked me if I'd fill in for him, so I said, okay, and so I came, and there were only two people left in the class, and there was one more class, and I thought, boy. You know, I mentioned this before, but in some sense, we really can't help others or ourselves. We insist on the world being any other way than the way it is. If we insist that our loved ones, ourselves, aren't subject to impermanence and vulnerability, we really can't help anyone. It's not like acceptance, like I'm not going to do anything about it, but it's like opening, this is the way it is. And sometimes it really is just to be with it, to bear it. And I think a lot of times when people, loved ones, are suffering, we just can't stand the pain of their suffering, so we try and fix it. But that's not helpful for them or us. It's really asking us to bear the unbearable, in a sense. To really be there with pain of others, to be of our own pain. So this is where equanimity comes in. It's the necessary aspect before we can really manifest compassion. It's the trust that we can be with this. And I think in part that trust, you know, comes from the wisdom part, to know that this is all impermanent. Whatever is going on is not going to last. Well, I was going through this, you know, I was sitting last week and this experience of memory of my son came up and I cried. And next thing you know, I'm out there walking on the beach in the snow. I mean, it's just like, and that's the beauty of impermanence, really. Life is like that. The worst thing in the world is happening and the next thing you know, it's gone. And then maybe it comes back. And it's just really amazing to start watching that. Just to notice, like, when you're in the deep and throes, and this is I can't deal with this, and then next thing you know, you're having a conversation with someone or something's happening, and that whole thing is not there for a while. So Sometimes it's really helpful to just ask how your breathing is, particularly me, since that's how I deal with it, by shutting down. I don't go up in the head and tell stories. I just, you know. It's a very unconscious kind of thing. It's just to notice that. Sometimes an equanimity phrase, may I hold this in the spaciousness of my heart. Or compassion, may I care for my pain and sorrow. Or may the other person care for their pain and sorrow. Whatever phrase works for you. There's just tons of stuff out there. And sometimes, you know, it doesn't have to, when you do a compassion phrase, it doesn't have to be some big, you know, really powerful motion. I mean, that's one thing that's been really interested for me in the last couple of months was just to explore, like, you know, just noticing, I'm actually just feeling the heart, just feeling how it is. And sometimes they're just, you know, may I care for this in a really light way, and there's a sense of tenderness there. There's kind of unconsciousness, not even knowing that you're resisting it, not even closing it. And just saying the words, maybe bringing your attention to the heart, just allows a little softening to take place. So sometimes, you know, we really can't go there. I mean, there might be anger, ill will. And it's not necessary to, you know, sometimes it's not even wise or possible to try and forgive. It's really to bring compassion, kindness to that feeling. To be with it enough to allow it to heal. And then we might ask ourselves, you know, do we really want to align ourselves with love, or we want to align ourselves with resentment or bitterness? Really, what's in our best interest? It isn't really about the other person. It's how our heart is affected. And sometimes there's anger at social injustice. I mean, all the horrible stuff that goes on in this world. I mean, it can be overwhelming. And my son was talking yesterday about just how angry he is. You know, he sort of felt like he's a sociopath because he's angry about all the stuff that goes on. But it's really a question of what we do with the anger. I mean, you got to be kind of a little bit dead not to react to this some. So, you know, anger can be the beginning of abandonment, like this is just hopeless, or it can be the beginning of commitment to helping others, to trying to be responsive to it. Sometimes compassion is intertwined with grief. And it's often, probably usually, a necessary response to loss. And it's not to have an idea of how long we should grieve. We really have to allow it to take its natural course. And it's not something to solve. I mean, we don't want to feed it. We want to tell stories that sort of contradict the whole nature of impermanence and all that sort of thing. But it's a bodily experience. We really need to come into the body, to open the body, to widen and soften our attention, to widen and soften our thoughts. And I know I've used this all the time, but Joseph Goldstein, the sky is blue, to notice the space around your body, and to allow that grief to be released, to express itself. And to notice, like other things, it comes and goes. It's not there all the time. And so we want to be, and this, what I have to say here really has to do with any emotions, not just grief, is we want to be with the experience but not lost in it. So there has to be kind of the right amount of distance from it. You don't want to totally disassociate from it, but you don't want to be overwhelmed by it. And one way I find helpful to think about it is there's a kind of energetic quality to the emotion, and there's an energetic quality to the quality of awareness. So when you find, if you find yourself getting lost in emotion, to see if you can bring more energy into the awareness. There's a wonderful story about this woman who just lost her two sons, her husband, This is back in the time of the Buddha, and she's walking around half crazed, her clothes are falling off. And the Buddha says, regain your presence of mind. He's telling her just this quality, of this witness quality, that can step back and see things rather than get lost in it. And, you know, it's really helpful to get someone to support us with our suffering, to help us hold it. But really, no one can care for our suffering better than ourselves. No one can bring compassion to ourselves better than ourselves. And the Buddha once said that you could search the whole world and not find anyone more deserving of love and compassion than yourself. And it's so often, I think, that people don't feel that they're worthy of it. But if you can't bring love and compassion to yourself, you can't bring it to anyone. So you're not doing it just for you. All of humanity benefits from it. So the way compassion is nourished is the willingness to touch suffering, to be with it, to open to it. And when we really open to what we go through, then it's much easier to relate to realize that everybody else is going through this. When I first started practice, and I was really a mess when I came here. I mean, I was outwardly very successful, but internally it was a mess. And I was suffering, and Ryan said something about, well, realize that someone else, that at this very moment, other people all over the world are going through experience almost exactly like yours. And I said, I didn't find that helpful. And she said, you know, honest yogi, you know. But I do now. I mean, it is not personal. I mean, in this society, so denies that suffering is a reality of life. And so we feel like we shouldn't have these difficulties. And what I love about teaching is when people open up, they drop their mask and their defenses, and there's this intimacy, this connection. And compassion just can be a natural, organic response when we don't react, when we don't move up in the head, when we don't defend, we don't blame, we're really open to it. Compassion arises. It's actually a pleasant sense. And when it's not, it's because we're reacting rather than responding to the situation. When my son was going through this really difficult experience, I met with him, and things were not going well, and I felt this heaviness. And then Narayan asked me about something. She sort of knew. She asked me something. I don't even remember what it was, but it just helped me hold it. And the aversion dropped away, and then there was just this quality of lightness. There's still a caring, a tenderness. But there wasn't, it shouldn't be like this. You know, it was like a really deep opening to this is how life is. And when we can learn to respond rather than react, there's really, it builds a sense of confidence. The more we can open to these, even start little things, and you start realizing, oh, I can be with this. I gave a talk, actually, one called Bow to Now. And it was just like going through holy hell. And it's sort of like at some points there's these moments of stillness and equanimity, and other parts there's just moments of incredibly being overwhelmed. And they just bow to it all. It's really, in some sense, it is a surrender. But it isn't something we can do. The surrender occurs from the wisdom of seeing that the resistance to it just doesn't work. So cultivation is not some grand endeavor. We don't need to save the world. We're not called upon to do that. The Buddha couldn't save the world. So we're raising pretty high expectations. I have my wife's a social worker who's actually trying to save the world, I think. But we just need to meet what's happening right now, and transform our own hearts and mind in this moment, just moment after moment, to dedicate ourselves to this practice of opening to suffering and caring for it, our suffering and suffering of others. So I want to read a little thing from Avalokitesvara. And in some sense, you know, can we learn to listen deeply and discover the heart that trembles in the face of suffering? So this is a song of Avalokitesvara, who's the goddess of compassion. We invoke your name, Avalokitesvara. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering in the world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We invoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without any prejudice. We will sit and listen without judging or reacting. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what the other person is saying and also what is being left unsaid. We know that just by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering in the other person. So can we come to people who are suffering, to loved ones who are suffering, and drop our agenda and meet them where they are? So our practice is just to dedicate, opening our heart in all circumstances and all situations. And it takes great courage of heart to do this. It's not an easy task, so it's not to judge yourselves, but it's to incline our heart and mind in that direction. So sometimes compassion means offering refuge to people who have no refuge, to being with people we really can't do anything for, but to be there with them. And gradually, through a sense of stillness and presence, it becomes more and more possible to do this. And by stillness, it's kind of this mind that's not reacting, not telling stories, not fabricating. It's just willing to be with what's there. Ultimately, there is simple responsiveness. There is no one giving compassion, and there's no one receiving compassion. It's really an expression of emptiness of wisdom. Okay. Okay, so we'll just open it up to anything people want to.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.